From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Another year is coming to a close, full of new discoveries and renewed hopes, but also a year filled with controversies, conflicts, and terror alerts across the globe. On December 2nd in San Bernardino, California, 14 people were killed and 21 injured in a mass shooting at the Inland Regional Center. Syed Rizwan Farooq and Tashfin Malik, a married couple, targeted a holiday party of about 80 employees and the San Bernardino County Department of Public Health. Both were killed by the police. It was the deadliest ISIS-inspired attack in the United States to date. On November 13th, in the heart of Europe, in Paris, the so-called Islamic State group claimed responsibility for killing 130 people and wounding many others in a series of coordinated attacks. The Schengen Agreement of Open Borders, a cornerstone of the European Union, is now coming under question, and terror alerts similar to those after the 9/11 attacks on U.S. soil are becoming a routine occurrence again around much of Europe, Africa, and the United States. Soon after the Paris attacks, we spoke with the British ambassador to the United States, Sir Peter Westmacott, and here is what he told us about sharing intelligence among EU member states, as well as about tightening borders after the Paris attack.
I think the point to remember when you're dealing with this kind of terrorist threat is that the bad guys have to get lucky just once, whereas the forces of goodness and truth, the forces of law and order, have to be vigilant and successful all the time if we are to stop any attacks. So, of course, after an event like this, everybody immediately looks at the intelligence and the traces they left behind to see what more we can learn about who they were, where they came from, who tasked them, and what further risks and threats there might be. So I myself wouldn't talk about weaknesses and failures and why didn't we stop it. It is really very difficult to be 100% sure. We've all been working on this for a long time. My Prime Minister has made clear the last few months we've stopped numerous ISIL-sponsored terrorist attacks in the United Kingdom. Who knows? The next successful attack could be in any one of a number of different cities. Doesn't mean to say that our intelligence services are not geared up, expanding their operations, improving their cooperation, but it does mean that we have to be even more vigilant and we have to be as strong as we can in learning the lessons from what's gone on. And one of the things that we are doing with our French friends and with our Belgian friends and our partners across Europe as well as here in the United States is trying to ensure that we've all got access to the same critical information so that we can head off this kind of thing before the next atrocity.
Well, speaking of this sharing of intelligence, that leads us, of course, to the problem of border security. Now, while Britain is not part of the Schengen area, to what extent do you think that these open borders among so many of the European Union countries might be, you know, under threat, that there will be greater, of course, border security? What impact might this have on Schengen rules that allow cross-border access?
Yeah. Well, this whole issue of migration combined with the terrorist threat is a huge crisis which is difficult for all of us to deal with. It is an existential issue, frankly, for the future of a borderless European Union. So there's two angles to it, really. One is the very large number of migrants fleeing countries where their life is no longer safe, a lot of them from Syria, but not only from Syria. We have migrants and refugees arriving from Afghanistan and Eritrea and Somalia, as well as from Syria and Iraq. So there are very large numbers of people coming into Europe which are putting a real pressure on the ability of those countries to absorb such very large numbers, as we have seen over the last few months. And then separately, you've got terrorists who have in many cases been born and brought up in European countries and gone to the region, coming back radicalized as foreign fighters and determined to come back across the border. So we have both to manage a very large humanitarian migration issue and we have to ensure that we can keep tabs on people who have got ill intent, terrorist plans coming across our borders with too much facility. So the two fit together. What does that mean for the future of Schengen and so on? Well, the European Union is looking at that very carefully. We've already seen that a number of member states are having to put up their own national frontiers. They are tightening controls where there were none before. In many cases, the border posts were there, but they were largely, you know, ineffective and not necessary. Now they are. For us, we're outside Schengen, as you say, and we're also protected by 25 miles of sea, which makes it a little bit easier for the United Kingdom to, if you like, manage its own borders. But I think it means that Europe both has to address the future of Schengen, which may mean that some changes need to be made, but that's up to the the member states concerned to decide, but also those of us who are outside Schengen, we will be even more anxious to ensure that our national border controls are effective so that we pick these people up at the border before they've had a chance to do harm.
The Islamic State, also known as ISIL, ISIS, or Daesh in Arabic, surged to fill the power vacuum, exploiting long-held resentments in the region and capturing American-provided equipment and weapons. French ambassador to the United States, His Excellency Gérard Araud, with whom we spoke in May, reminded us about the root causes of Daesh.
You know, usually when you analyze Daesh, you see only the atrocities of the movement. But unfortunately, there is also behind it a geopolitical reality. The Sunnis of the region, because of the Syrian civil war, and because also of the way Prime Minister Maliki behaved in Baghdad, the Sunnis don't feel represented. And in a sense, Daesh has succeeded to appear as the defender, really defending the Sunnis against the Shiite majority in Iraq and against the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. So as long as the Sunnis in Iraq don't trust the government in Baghdad, you know, Daesh will find a constituency. So the problem is to create a real inclusive government in Baghdad, and it's what the prime minister is trying to do. But obviously, he has not yet convinced the Iraqi Sunnis of what he is trying to do. So we have to support the government in Baghdad and really in his endeavor to reach out to the Sunnis. That's the first part in Iraq. But I should emphasize the crisis is a Syrian crisis, first of all. Daesh has taken advantage of the Maliki policy to spread over to Iraq from Syria. So as long as we don't solve the Syrian crisis, it's very likely that Daesh will be able to do and to act the way we are seeing they are acting now. So I guess my nuance would be the priority has to be to solve the Syrian crisis.
Most analysts agree with Ambassador Araud that to solve the crisis with ISIS, we have to solve the Syrian conflict first. In September, Russia unexpectedly joined the fight in Syria to prop up Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia's move complicated the talks towards resolving the crisis held by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and other negotiators. We asked Ali Soufan, the CEO of the Soufan Group based in New York City, what was behind Russia's intervention in the Middle East.
I think Russia is not looking at its campaign in Syria as an anti-ISIS campaign. They are looking at the campaign as a pro-regime campaign, pro-Assad campaign. And I think they send a very strong message from day one when they bombed locations that some of it has nothing to do with ISIS. So you had airstrikes against al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria. You had also airstrikes against Ahrar al-Sham, which is an Islamist organization very closely associated with al-Nusra and with al-Qaeda Central. However, it's also independent from them, and Ahrar al-Sham is closely connected with Turkey. So it was a strong message that their campaign is a pro-Assad campaign, not anti-terrorism campaign. The Russians feel the militant groups in Syria, regardless if they were FSA or Islamists or Qaeda or ISIS, everyone who is fighting the regime is going to be, according to them, considered terrorists. Also, the groups that they targeted, I believe they were sending a message to the regional backers. As you know, in Syria, after 4 years of conflict, every group is supported by someone or a country. And I think bombing these groups was also a strong message from the Russians to the regional backers. It seems after 4 years, Russia found an opportunity to interfere in Syria. Again, the Russians were looking for their national interest in Syria. Remember, Syria throughout the Cold War was a country that operated under the Soviet influence. It continued to be pro-Russia, and Russia have significant naval bases, especially in the Latakia and Tartus. So Russia has a lot to lose if the Assad regime cease to exist. But also at the same time, the Russians are very wary at this point, are very wary of the situation on the ground. Remember, you have thousands and thousands of foreign fighters They are not probably worried about the foreign fighters that they come from North Africa or from Europe as much as they worry about the fighters that they come from Central Asia and countries and nations that are considered part of the Russian sphere of influence. You have a few thousands that came from places like Chechnya, Uzbekistan, and so forth, Tajikistan. Also, you have a significant amount of recruits that's coming to fight in Syria, and they are already in Syria, who are Turkic from Central Asia. And Russia is very fearful. Russia and China are both very fearful of Turkic nationalism in Central Asia, especially Islamist type of Turkic nationalism of Central Asia. So Russia is looking for its interest, absolutely. Putin always wanted to expand the Russian influence, not only in the region, in the Middle East, but also, as we've seen his actions in Georgia and the Ukraine and so forth. And he found a great opportunity. And you cannot blame him for taking that opportunity.
Although in recent months, ISIS, for obvious reasons, drew the world's attention, according to Ali Soufan, it is not by any means the only violent extremist group in the volatile Middle East, North Africa, or South Asia.
Al-Qaeda today have thousands and thousands of followers. The idea of Osama bin Laden is way more popular today than when bin Laden was alive. Remember, ISIS, Daesh, came out of Al-Qaeda. It used to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq. ISIS believed that they are bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, not Zawahiri's Al-Qaeda. So the division between them is a division about leadership, not about ideology. So I think if you look at the map today, if you look at Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, if you look at what's happening with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, in the Sahel region, if you look at the Shabab movement in Somalia, if you look at Ansari Sharia and ISIS in North Africa and Libya and in Tunisia, if you look at Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and how powerful it became, at least after the campaign in Yemen, if you look at the army that Nusra have in Syria, if you look at, ISIS and Iraq, most of the Middle East, most of these countries, huge regions in these countries are controlled by violent extremists, controlled by non-state actors. And I think that's going to create significant damage to not only regional security, but also to global security.
For years, the Middle East and the world had been looking up to the United States for leadership. Elected to end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, President Obama decided it was time for America to step back from being the world's policeman and let others take the lead. Such a doctrine was called leading from behind, and some analysts and policymakers across the political spectrum suggested that this so-called retreat from the world stage may have contributed to a vacuum, especially in the Middle East, which was filled by the likes of ISIS. Ed Royce, Republican congressman from the state of California and chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, told VOA in June that the U.S. Congress was working tirelessly towards resolving the Middle East conundrum.
Let me briefly explain two problems that I've seen so far. One is we do need an overarching strategy, and we really haven't had an effective strategy. But the second aspect of this is that the government in Baghdad really needs to work more cooperatively with the Sunni tribes that are fighting ISIS and with the Kurdish forces that are fighting ISIS. And I say that after multiple meetings with leaders of the Sunni tribes and leaders of the Kurdish Peshmerga that are carrying out a lot of they're taking the casualties. And they need to get some of the weaponry, such as artillery or anti-tank missiles or long-range mortars, to better protect and defend themselves. So that's one aspect of the problem. The other aspect is that the United States could do more in terms of the use of our air power and have, some of our people forward deployed as spotters to call in the airstrikes against ISIS, embed them with the Iraqi forces. That will make it more effective as well. So my hope is that we have a combination of both better participation out of Baghdad with giving the resources and working more closely with the Sunni population and Kurdish population, and second, better engagement on the part of the United States in terms of helping on the airstrikes that are needed for air cover when Iraqi forces are battling ISIS.
Let me pick up on one of your comments, which is to help the Sunni forces, the Sunni tribal groups and Kurds. Some analysts say that we need a better political strategy because this is not, that is, the Islamic militant group, the Islamic State, is not going to be defeated militarily, that we need to help the Iraqi government, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, to be more inclusive with the Sunni tribes.
That's
because
what I'm
saying. Exactly. So this is political, though.
No, well, it is political, and they failed to do it over and over again. Now, the current government is better than the prior Maliki government, but they still have a long way to go to really being even-handed on this. Second, we could have been more decisive in the early days of this air campaign when, obviously, you had ISIS leaving its compound in Syria and going over the border into Iraq. We should have hit these ISIS fighters from the air at that time, and there were many who called for that action to take place. We're finally doing that in Syria, and you know, before they took cities like Mosul, right? There was a call for them to do that before they took Fallujah for the use of air power. Now, I'm sure this is more complicated than it seems at the moment to you and me, but it is clear that two things have to happen, and you've just identified, you know, the fact that Baghdad needs to be equitable in its treatment of Kurds and Sunnis, and inclusive, as you said. That is absolutely right.
Indeed, and as I said, analysts are saying here in the United States and elsewhere that it is the United States government that could be placing more pressure, notwithstanding the challenges, on Haider al-Abadi and other politicians in Iraq. So from your perspective, do you see that
happening?
As
chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, that is what we're doing. The way I'm trying to do it is to say, look, if you won't transfer weapons to the Kurds so they can defend themselves, or if you won't transfer the weapons to the tribes that are fighting ISIS, you know, in Anbar, then the United States will do that. And we've got to say that to Baghdad. We've got to say, you must do this, because they're the ones taking the casualties out on the front line. You've got 180,000 Kurdish Peshmerga. 30% of those fighters are women. And they're down there with nothing more, you know, than small arms up against ISIS. They deserve the weapons that they're asking for to help them defend their positions.
And thus, many analysts suggest that the migrant crisis in Europe or the rise of ISIL in Iraq and Syria might have been forestalled had Washington and her allies acted sooner. And Chairman Royce says Syria's neighbors should be very much involved in this effort.
I mean, we need to be doing this in conjunction also with countries in the region, the Jordanians, Turkey, other states that are stakeholders in this that have shared sort of the same observations I'm making right now, that the time is now to come to the aid, you know, in terms of protection. And that's the step I think all of us could agree on, or should agree on, in terms of protecting the civilian communities up there in Aleppo and in the north. And you have the same situation near the Jordanian border, where we could be doing the same thing.
There are obstacles, though, Mr. Royce, in the administration and even among some Republican congressional members about a more, let's say, robust policy vis-a-vis Syria that you were suggesting.
But I'm suggesting to the administration we need a more robust policy, and we've suggested this for some time with our hearings, because otherwise the circumstances that you alluded to earlier are the ones you create, and you don't want to create a vacuum where, you know, ISIS begins to, currently they've taken close to half of the country. And so it is very important that we take these steps, but we do it with Turkey and Jordan and other countries in the region.
On July 14, 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action between Iran and the P5 plus one countries, that is the United States, the UK, Russia, France, China, and Germany, was reached after several missed deadlines. It requires Iran to accept curbs on its nuclear program in exchange for a comprehensive lifting of sanctions imposed by the United Nations and by individual countries. Many prominent lawmakers in the U.S. Congress, including Chairman Royce, criticized the deal.
I subscribe to former President Ronald Reagan's concept of trust but verify. The verification is absolutely essential here. And I sent a letter with Elliot Engel, my ranking Democrat member. We sent that with the signatures of 367 members of Congress, vast majority of the House of Representatives, to say, Mr. President, make certain that the international inspectors have the ability to go on the military bases, to go, you know, anywhere, anytime to do these inspections, because if we do not have verification in the agreement, then the problem is going to be just like the North Korean framework agreement in 94, which I remember. We didn't have that in the agreement, and as a consequence, North Korea cheated and ended up with the undetectable nuclear breakout capability, and they two-tracked their plutonium and enriched uranium programs, and now they have the weapon. So that's where we need to push in the negotiation. That's why a majority of Democrats and almost all the Republicans sent my letter, co-signed it to the president, and that's what we want our negotiators to push for. It's really important.
The French ambassador to the United States, His Excellency Gérard Araud, had a different take on the Iran deal.
Like in any negotiation, the better deal for them is not the better deal for us. So we are in the middle of a traditional negotiation. So there is nothing surprising. And in one side, you have six negotiators. You know, really, there are nuances. But we have the same goal, all of us, the U.S., France, and the other negotiators. We want to prevent Iran from getting the nuclear weapon. That's very clear. But the Iranian problem in the region is not only based on the nuclear issue, it's simply the fact that Iran is conducted a very active policy in Syria, where the regime of Bashar al-Assad is holding only because of the Iranian support, financial and military support. But also, as you know, the Iranians are also very active in Iraq now and in Yemen. So we have to understand the concerns of our friends, the country in the Gulf. As for the nuclear deal, for instance, the Gulf states are telling us that for them, the problem is not so much the nuclear deal itself. It's because Iran, without sanctions, will get a lot of money and will use this money to destabilize further the region. So we have to listen to them. We have to give them the necessary assurances of our commitment to their security. And it's exactly what President Obama did in Camp David. And it's what we are trying also the French to do.
As the French ambassador was saying, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries have many misgivings about the Iran nuclear deal. We asked Hisham Melhem, a columnist and analyst for the Al Arabiya news channel in Washington, who was our guest on Press Conference USA in July, what he thought about it.
Do I take that as you're in favor of the deal? Do you think the deal is better than not having a deal, or could it have been better negotiated?
If you talk specifically about the nuclear part, yes, it's not a bad deal. My problem with the administration is not the technical part of the deal, it's Iran's policy in the region and the total failure of this administration to address Iran's nefarious activities, malign activities throughout the region. The administration is not talking at all about human rights violations in Iran. In fact, the administration let down the Iranian people in 2009 when they rebelled in the streets in a peaceful way. And the president did not really respond to their legitimate yearning for democracy and empowerment. So my problem with the administration is Iran as the regional hegemon. It's not Iran as the country that is developing some nuclear knowledge. Look, you know, the Iranians look around them in the region and they say 8 years ago there was no such thing as Pakistan. Today, there is a state named Pakistan with 100 nuclear warheads. We are Persia. We are the inheritors of a great pre-Islamic civilization. We are the inheritors of a great Islamic civilization. We have a permanency. We have civilizational heft. When you negotiate with great cultures like the Chinese or the Iranians or the Indians, these people have a sense of continuity, have a sense of permanence, have a sense of identity. They have a sense of empowerment and they have a sense of entitlement. And that's what you have with Iran. I mean, I feel sorry sometimes for American officials or European officials negotiating with a country like that, because those negotiators on the Iranian side don't act according to 4-year cycle or 6-year cycle or whatever. And in the end, let me be blunt about this. For a country that measures its history in millennia and centuries, what is it to delay or to suspend or to freeze any program for 10 years or 15 years? It's merely a fleeting moment in the history of that country. That's what you have to keep in mind.
The Middle East is by no means a monolith, and there are significant divisions among Arab countries. According to Hisham Melhem, Iran is taking advantage of that lack of Arab center or Arab unity.
I think a lot of people would be disappointed with this performance. If you look around, the president has very little to show for in the Middle East except the Iranian deal. And assuming that it will pass, that will be his legacy in the Middle East. But that has nothing to do with the Cairo speech, opening up a new page with the Muslim world and with the Arab world in terms of helping them in terms of democracy, empowerment, better relationship with the United States. We've seen a great deal of alienation between both the peoples of the Arab world, let me be specific about this, and the leaderships of the Arab world. And by the way, if you look at the whole region, this is one of the few moments where you have the American president not having good relationship with the Israelis, the Arabs, and the Turks. And maybe he's improving his relationship with the Iranians. That is ironic, to say the least.
But when we spoke to James Clyburn, a Democratic congressman from South Carolina, he told us that most of President Obama's critics are homegrown and that the president has been treated unfairly by many members of Congress, especially the opposition Republicans. Referring to the Iran deal, here is what he told VOA back in May.
I don't think that Congress ought to have any right to circumvent the president. Now, this foolishness that's been going on up here is just that foolishness. And we have to be very, very careful. And for people not to see, look, I'm old enough to have seen and to pay close attention to many presidents, all the way back to Truman. I first got interested in politics when Truman ran against Dewey back in 1948. And I've been following closely every president since. And so I will say to my friends, be very, very careful how you treat this president, because the turnabout is fair play. Exactly. And I think that this president has not been treated with the dignity and respect that he should be treated with, especially when it comes to his dealings with foreign countries. And that, to me, is a big problem here. So I support this country speaking with one voice when we get beyond the water's edge.
Speaking of President Obama, one issue that has always been very important to him at home and which has no doubt cost him many sleepless nights has been racial profiling and the excessive use of force by some law enforcement officers against African Americans or people of color. This past year was marked by a string of controversial cases around the country involving excessive use of force by police, such as the shooting of an unarmed teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, and a man who died in police custody in Baltimore. We asked Democratic Congressman James Clyburn about this issue back in May.
This has been an issue for a long time. And I think that what has caused the problem to seem to manifest itself is the fact that people are now seeing it. We've heard it for a long time. It's been there. I grew up in the South. I grew up knowing what it's like to go into a department store and have a police officer follow you around the department store. I know what it's like to be profiled. And so for people to think that this is something new, the only thing that's new is now people are using their mobile phones to record some of this. I remember several years ago, the incident was in Rodney King out in California. Rodney King became a sensational issue simply because people saw it. But these kinds of complaints have been made in California for a long time. And so in Charleston, that was my congressional district, Walter Scott. People saw it. And we even saw the police officer seeming to plant evidence. All of that's on the screen. Now, we've been hearing that forever, that police officers, many of them, carry around an extra weapon of sorts just for that kind of purpose. I've been hearing that for as long as I can remember. So this isn't anything new. Just seeing it is now believing.
And so it goes. Next year, Americans will elect a new president, and whether it is a Democrat or a Republican, his or her plate will be full. That's all the time we have on this special edition of Press Conference USA. Before we close, we want to remind you that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a fiercely loyal listener from Mogadishu, Somalia, Daoud Abdul Qadir Hussein. Don't forget, if you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you a very healthy and happy new year. Thanks to Anna Zalewski and Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the show. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week and next year for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.